So we're really travelling the globe in this episode, aren't we, Orla?
We are. We're sort of pushing international horizons of this one, aren't we? Venturing into new unknown territories. We've got South America's first ever Olympic Games. We've got Africa's first ever female team. We've got a very international flavour this month.
And Madrid,
yes.
Don't forget Madrid and the finish of the first ever Women's World Tour.
You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, with Orla Shenoui and Richard Moore.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore and I'm with Orla Shenoui.
Hello.
And the sound of slurping.
You make it sound so elegant.
No energy balls. Think,
no energy
balls. You brought a well-known energy drink.
Well, the thing is, usually we do this round at my gaff. And I provide healthy treats for Richard Moore in the form of homemade energy bowls or the last time I made some rather special coffee. This time I'm doing it round at Richard's, so I thought I'd better bring my own fuel. So I did. So I'm slurping away, yes, at a rather unsavoury...
Give you a cup of tea.
You did. It was lovely. Your wife gave me a cup of tea, actually. Oh, no, it was you.
It was me. It might look similar. But anyway, Orla, it's been a while. Because we last spoke just before the Olympic Games. And then you were away to Rio for the Olympic Games. And then I was away to the Vuelta a España. So it's been a while. You've been back now a few weeks from the Olympics. We've got lots to cover in this episode. We'll talk about the Olympics in the first part. We both had a chat earlier today with Joanna Rousel-Shand. So we'll hear from her as well in this first part. Second part, we'll talk about the Madrid Challenge, which was the final event in the Women's World Tour. Got a couple of interviews from there as well. And in the final part, we're going to hear about the new African women's team, Africa Rising. And we've got an interview about that as well. So first off, I mean, how was Rio? You were complaining a moment ago that it was awful and just really hard work. And you only got out dancing once.
I did only get to dance once. I wasn't complaining. When you asked how it was, I said, yeah, it was very hard work. And I mean, that was partly because Team GB just did so incredibly well and really did surpass, I think, all expectations with how well they did cycling in particular, well, track cycling. They were just phenomenal. It's difficult to know whether they surpassed their own expectations or not because lots of people say lots of different things. When I spoke to Sir Chris Hoy before the games got underway, he pretty much named every medal as it was won. So he was expecting them to do as well as they did. The rest of the world certainly weren't, but it was partly their success that made it quite difficult. It was a hard games, very, very different in feeling and atmosphere to London. Unfortunately, there wasn't the same enthusiasm. There wasn't that, sorry to use this word, but carnival atmosphere that we had been hoping for.
The whole city is bought into and has been infected by it in a way.
Yeah, it wasn't like that at all. In fact, the road races were so bare, it was unreal. The time trial, for example, I mean, I remember standing at Hampton Court Palace at London 2012 as the men's time trial was finishing, and it was so electrifying. You could feel it coursing through your veins almost. Well, at Rio, I mean, you could count the number of people that you could see around you. It was a quite dank, miserable day. So it didn't have the same feel, but it was a great games. And Team GB did fantastically well. And yeah, we're going to hear from some of the girls who did just a brilliant job on the track especially. So credit to them.
Let's get to that. But the cycling program kicked off, of course, on the road. Mm-hmm. And the big talking point from the women's road race was the awful crash for Annemiek van Vleuten, the Dutch rider, who would have won gold medal, wouldn't she, if she'd stayed upright. And we saw it in the men's race as well. And it's very difficult to be critical of her, but she herself said afterwards, and I think you interviewed her, didn't you, that she made a mistake. And, you know, the road was dangerous, it was risky, but most of these crashes were caused by some kind of rider error. And that's not to sort of diminish the seriousness, because I think when we saw it and, you know, watching it on TV, it's one of those awful moments where you thought the outcome could be the very worst that you could imagine. And that was awful. And the eventual winner, Anna van der Breggen, her Dutch teammate, I read an interview with her this week in Pro Cycling Magazine, where, you know, the three of them who then chased down Mara Abbott, who had been with van Vleuten a bit earlier on, they were also having passed the stricken van Vleuten. They were unsure, you know, about what the outcome would be. for them, Van der Breggen especially, to remain sort of focused on the task at hand was quite incredible. Apparently, Emma Johansson said to her, you know, do it for Annemiek. And yeah, what was she like when you went to see her?
I find it quite funny, really, because as you say, it was a heart-stopping moment, really, watching that crash. And we weren't watching it at the time because we were at the finish line. I only got to see it afterwards. But you really did fear the worst. And so everyone external to that race was talking about how dangerous it was and just hoping for the best for her. And we were doing regular updates on as to her state of health. But when I went to interview her and asked her about the crash, I perhaps naively assumed that she would be a bit more philosophical about the crash itself and maybe just how close it could have come to being an absolute disaster. But her entire mindset was just focused on the fact that she lost the race.
That was a sense I had as well, yeah.
It was, and it really blew me away and made me realise just how much of a mere mortal I am compared to someone like that who has spent, I guess, the last 4 year cycle building towards this race.
Now, I'm not sure about that, Orla. I might just pull you up on that point because there was a moment, and I don't know if you want me to share this with podcast listeners.
Oh, you're invited. I don't know what you're going to say.
We were exchanging messages during the Olympic Games, and there was a moment, you know, there were lots of security issues and stuff, and there was something thrown at the media bus that was thought to be the media bus was shot at one
yes.
night. Yes. And apparently your first reaction to that was, we should have been on that bus.
Richard!
You're the journalism equivalent of Annemiek van Vleuten.
Well, yeah, you want to be in the centre of the action, don't you? I mean, I did think when that happened, I thought, sugar, we could have been on that bus. I could have been reporting on that. Yeah, we thought they were shot at. But anyway, they luckily weren't. We think they were just stoned.
Yeah.
But to go back to Annemiek, I asked her, she had only just watched the crash back again. Mm. And so again, I thought she would say a little bit more about how shockingly bad the crash itself looked, maybe how lucky she was to have to be sitting there just a few days later talking about it. But again, she said she didn't look at the crash itself. She was looking at everything in the build up to it and what could have been, what might have been, and I guess what should have been in her mind. And every morning she woke up still devastated that she hadn't got that gold medal that she could have gone on to win, rather than, I guess, the likes of you and I would be thinking, I'm lucky to be alive. Everyone around her, like she was saying about her mother and how desperately worried she was about the situation. But thankfully, she made a fantastic recovery.
And she's 33, so, you know, potentially probably her last chance to win a gold medal in the Olympic Games, maybe. I don't know. But
potentially. Kristen Armstrong, though,
yeah,
gold
true.
in the time trial, although road race slightly different.
Yeah,
but yeah
slightly different.
Yeah,
but probably. Certainly she wasn't a favourite going into it, and I think it was a surprise to see her in a race-winning position. And I think, you know, she'll be very aware of that. I did have it in mind to go and see her for the cycling podcast Femina over the winter and you know, do a story about her convalescence, thinking it would be months before we'd see her again. Mm. But she actually returned to racing in early September and won the Lotto Belgium Tour. She won the prologue and the final stage. That's quite remarkable, really, just weeks after the crash. So, you know, the injury is not as bad, perhaps, as first feared. I should clarify my earlier comments about the rider error element to the crashes. I think the crashes were caused by rider error. I think the layout of the road created a second danger and a serious danger. And I think this was a point Chris Boardman made as well, that, you know, in the event of a rider error, and rider errors happen all the time, the consequences were nasty, mm-hmm. because of the way the ditch and the way the road was laid out. So I think the course could have been safer.
It should be said as well that when I spoke to Annemiek van Vleuten, she wasn't in any way critical of the race organiser. She said that she knew that was a dangerous corner, and as you say, she says she overshot it. The question has to be asked, though, as it was indeed by Chris Boardman, just how much all of that was taken into consideration, given that this is the Olympic Games, given that it was a hilly course, this is the final descent.
People are going to take risks.
People are going to take risks. Is that where you want a risky corner to be?
Okay, let's go back to Rio, Orla, and to a chat that you had with Becky James and Katie Marchant. Becky James, of course, we featured a longer interview with her in the last podcast, Cycling Podcast Feminine 3, which came out just before the Olympic Games. She had a terrible few years and went to Rio and won silver medals in the sprint and the Keirin, which probably felt like gold medals for her. So here they are, Becky James and Katie Marchant.
Well, we're standing on a balcony overlooking the Olympic Park in Rio de Janeiro, a beautiful setting, and two beautiful smiles in front of me. Becky James, Katie Marchant, congratulations on your medals. What's this whole experience been like, Becky?
Absolutely amazing. It's completely different place, and just the whole experience of the Olympics has just been incredible, like nothing we've ever experienced before. Sorry, losing my voice. But yeah, like, didn't really expect to come away with two medals. You know, I was always coming here targeting a medal, and I think that's just made it a sweeter trip.
We knew of your journey to get here. We've covered it in the cycling podcast before. How much more special does it make, those two medals, an Olympic record as well?
Yeah, it's so special, and hearing that now, it's very surreal. Doesn't feel like it's actually happened, especially getting the Olympic record. I knew I had good form, and I knew I was going to go quite fast, but not taking the Olympic record, so I'm chuffed to bits with that. But I came here targeting a medal in the Keirin, and I think whatever happened in the sprint was a bonus, but then when I qualified fastest, I thought, oh gosh, I need to sort of get the results in the sprint now. And but just took them like a step at a time, each race as it came, and was chuffed to bits to get into the final. Just missing out on that gold was a little bit frustrating, but you know, if someone had told me a couple of months ago I'd get two medals in the Olympics, I'd have taken it.
And Katie, the sprint spots, I guess, for these games have been a little contentious. You have shown everyone here just what you can do.
Yeah, I'm really, really happy with my result here. So I'm just absolutely chuffed to bits, yeah.
What was it like standing in the podium next to Becky here?
Oh, it was a dream come true. I couldn't wish to stand on the podium with a nicer, more amazing person. I love Becky to bits, and she's helped me through this journey, and I've always looked up to her, and to stand on the podium at the end of the games is just a absolute dream come true.
There's been so much happening, hasn't there, within British cycling back home, so much upheaval. Has that distracted in any way in the build-up to these games?
I think we knew what we were focusing on. We go to train every day, and we know what we've got to do, and there's a job at hand, and the coaches have been amazing, and all the team that work with us, and I think it just shows the results that we've had here. British cycling is an amazing, we have an amazing setup, and it's an amazing team of people, so...
And what about you, Becky? You know, you're close to Shane Sutton. Yeah. What does it mean to you to be winning these medals, having had his support?
Yeah, I can't thank him enough for his support. You know, when it came down to selection for World Cups, and, you know, he said I'd be up for medals in Rio, and, like, I couldn't have imagined it at the time, and I was thinking, oh, I didn't want to let him down, like, if that he was picking me for World Cups, and then I was getting knocked out in the first round. But he said, you know, he believed in me, and he believed that I'd get back by the Olympics in time, and it all worked out. So yeah, you know, if he hadn't have helped me along the way, you know, I wouldn't be stood here now, so I can't thank him enough for that.
So what next? I mean, the state of women's cycling and Team GB looks very healthy indeed, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really exciting. You know, we've got such a strong team, and, you know, it's going to be really exciting to be racing together again soon.
Yeah, like Beck said, we're going to get back to Manchester. We'll have a couple of weeks break and we'll just see what happens. We'll get back into training and see how we're feeling, but it's very exciting. I think British cycling are incredibly good at their job, and it makes it as easy as possible for us, really.
A night out in Rio first?
Yeah, so we had a little bit of a night out last night, but we got in really late from after doping and stuff from the track, and then obviously we knew we were up really early this morning, so we've had a couple of hours sleep, but we're definitely going to celebrate tonight.
Bit of samba, Becky?
Oh, yes.
Congratulations, Chris. Thank you very much.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Go to rafa.cc for more information.
So that was Becky James and Katie Marchant back in Rio. That must have taken you back, Orla, hearing that.
It did, actually. And as I was describing the scene, I could see it again in my head, just where we were standing, a bright, sunny day. And it brings me back to the craziness of it. And when I said that it was really hard work, it was, but it was fantastic. And we were just blessed to have all these athletes coming to us with so many stories of success. And yeah, it was a brilliant, brilliant Games, really.
Well, as you said earlier, the British domination in the track was quite extraordinary, unexpected by Chris Hoy. But, you know, I was at the Vuelta and I spoke to Dave Brailsford, who used to be principal performance director at British Cycling. And he said, he claimed that nobody at British Cycling really saw that coming. And that he said, you know, it shows you how little we know about this game of elite sport, really, because that was, to him, unexpected. And he said to a lot of the senior people at British Cycling, unexpected.
Maybe he's just out of the loop, you never know.
Maybe he's not being told things, I don't know. But yeah, it was amazing. And earlier today, we spoke to Joanna Reisel-Shand, a member of the Team Pursuit team, also a member of the goal-winning Team Pursuit team in London 4 years ago, the senior member of the team, as she points out in the interview. Shall we hear from her now? Here's Joanna Reisel-Shand.
first few days after the race, it's hard to adjust because you're so ingrained into the thoughts of mustn't spend time on my feet. And it was really nice luxury to be able to walk in the village to the dining hall rather than taking my bike and locking the bike up every time I went anywhere to save my legs. That night I got pizza back at the village, which I'd been craving the whole week. I was dying for some pizza because the food wasn't good. And the first thing I thought was, oh, I've not got any protein. And then I thought, oh, it doesn't matter. I don't have to eat 30 grams of protein every few hours anymore. I can eat what I want. So yeah, it does take, it took a few days to adjust, but quite quickly you start enjoying yourself and it's nice not to have to do all those little things. People always talk about the post-Olympic come down, but for me, I've really looked forward to doing some normal things. I know it's not really normal going to film premieres and stuff, but for me, it's nice to be able to be on my feet and wearing heels and not feeling bad that my legs are aching and not worrying about what time I go to bed and not worrying about what I'm eating and just enjoy being able to say yes to things. So I really enjoyed myself. I've been to the Bridget Jones premiere, the GQ Awards, the National Lottery Awards. I've seen so many like friends and family, met loads of kids who are all very excitable about the Olympics, which is very nice. So I've really enjoyed all of that. I mean, I think it does, the novelty does tend to wear off after a while, but it's really nice to have everybody appreciate our success. I think we'd hate it if we came back and everyone was just not bothered, like, oh yeah, whatever, you went to Rio, you got yourself a medal. But I think it's about sharing that with everybody. So I've really enjoyed meeting everybody and seeing the direct impact it's had on people and how happy it's made them. It's hard to take it all in the moment because you train for years and the event is over in just over 4 minutes. And it's very surreal because everyone's congratulating you and you're just like, what the hell just happened there? You know, you spend all this time building up and then it's over so quickly. But then I landed back in the UK and there was security meeting us off the plane and there was photographers and reporters and TV cameras at the airport. And I flew back early. I didn't fly back on the big flight. I flew back on the Thursday, so before the second week had finished. But I couldn't believe the response back here in the UK because I thought it would be a lot less than it was after London. But it's actually been, I say I've been recognised more than I was after London, actually. And there's been so many people coming up to me saying they've watched the cycling, they don't normally watch it, but they loved it. I really like the noise of the crowd. In the final, I was saying to the other girls, I could hear the difference in the crowd. When we went in the lead, everyone gave like a massive cheer. And those people said to me, how could that mean we were winning? It could have easily meant it was a really close race or it was going really badly or they could have been cheering the Americans on. I felt that was a cheer for us. So perhaps it was a little presumptuous to assume that, but all the noise from the crowd, that works really well for me. So the more the better, we like the crowd. There's been a lot of talk about our kits and our, you know, our new bikes and everything, which definitely were faster than the old bikes. You know, definitely made a difference. I felt faster on that bike, but it's not a game changer. It's a marginal gain, adds a little bit, but you know, it's not going to knock off loads of seconds off your time. I'm off to Club La Santa on Sunday, where I'm going to do the triathlon. And I'll do some bike riding out there in the sun. But also, I'm keen to try all the different sports out there because you can do pretty much any sport at Club La Santa. But normally when I go out there training, I'm too busy actually on the bike to be able to do all the other activities. You know, the badminton tournaments and the tennis tournaments and the kayaking and all that sort of thing. And then training throughout October. Then in November, I'm off for my honeymoon for 3 weeks. I got married last summer, but we postponed the honeymoon until after Rio. But then my husband's got an exam in October and an exam at the start of November. So with all other things in the calendar, it wasn't until November that we could actually get 3 weeks in a row to go away together. So we've got our long-awaited honeymoon in November for 3 weeks. So I'll train up till then, and then I've got another 3 weeks off the bike. And then December, possibly the worst weather of the year, I'll really start cracking on again.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Go to rafa.cc for more information.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast Femina. We're very grateful to them for their support. They are supporting the Cycling Podcast as a whole and obviously the Cycling Podcast Femina as part of that. To Madrid, Orla.
Indeed,
we're going to Madrid now.
From Rio to Madrid.
To Madrid via South London. No, we weren't in Madrid, but Hannah Troop was there for the Cycling Podcast Femina. And she spoke to a few people. The race was won by Yolene Doer, the Belgian rider from Ghent, who rides for Wiggle. High five. And it was, I mean, it's a very similar race to the La Course in Paris at the end of the Tour de France. And I think we spoke about La Course and its limitations as an event. And we're going to hear just now from Carly Taylor, the Liv Planteur rider, Australian rider, who's a climber, and she talks a little bit about, you know, the sorts of things that she would like to see in more women's races. Let's hear from her. She speaks initially about the Madrid Challenge and then goes into some more general observations and thoughts about women's racing, about the Women's World Tour. Here is Carly Taylor.
It was pretty hot out there and actually pretty tough.
Yeah.
You think, oh, yeah, it's just going to be laps and a type of a kermis, but, yeah, it was actually pretty hard, that climb. I'm a climber and I still classified that as a climb. But, yeah, there was a lot of attacks and it was a tough race. And, yeah, at the end of the day, it did come down to a sprint, which was what we wanted, but that breakaway got caught late, so, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was, and also the heat, it's been so warm today as well, isn't it?
Yeah. You could feel it like straight away, and I guess, you know, when you start racing at 2:45, you're racing in the heat of the day as well. And like, I'm lucky I'm Australian, I'm a little bit used to the heat, but you could definitely tell that the girls, that was an aspect that made the race harder.
And so you've now got to like the final race of the Women's World Tour. How do you think it's been this year? What do you think, it's been much different from last year?
Yeah, I actually think that having the Women's World Tour has really lifted women's cycling, and it's been a massive step in the right direction. I mean, in all the rest of the years, it's just been a World Cup and one-day events, and riders that win one-day events are usually a little bit different type of rider than a rider that wins a tour. And like having the Giro as a Women's World Tour event, that's a hard race, and beforehand it never used to even be like, yeah, it was just a tour. So including those types of races has definitely kind of made it, I reckon, like a lot more diverse in the people that are getting, like, that are up there in the Women's World Tour points and stuff. And yeah, it's really lifted the racing, I think.
And we've seen, like, for you as a climber, there's been some quite historic climbs this year with like the Mortirolo and Ventoux. How has that been?
Yeah, this year racing up both of those climbs, you kind of, when you're young, you grow up watching those types of climbs being raced in the women, in the men's peloton, and you kind of dream about doing that, and like you don't even know how hard it is, you can't kind of comprehend it. But racing up Mortirolo this year in the women's Giro d'Italia, that's a hardcore, that's a hard climb, like 12% for 12 kilometers, that's the average. There's just no easy part of it. And yeah, Mont Ventoux too, recently in the Tour of Ardèche, yeah, I kind of remembered watching it this year when the men went up in the Tour de France, and they make it kind of look easy when you're watching it on TV, but when you actually hit it, you have this newfound appreciation of how hard it really is. But yeah, it's awesome to have those types of climbs in women's racing, because like we train just as hard as the guys, and a lot of the times we actually do train with the guys, so we can race up those races, like those climbs, like we're tough enough to be able to do that. And it's kind of good to include that in women's cycling, because yeah, it makes the race interesting, and like, yeah, we're good enough to race up the same climbs as the men.
So do you train with some of the guys up in Girona then?
Yeah, there's a fair few cyclists in Girona, and yeah, a few guys that I train with. I always think, like, I grew up in South Australia, and we always used to train with the men back at home, and so I think training with the men always pushes you to that next step. And like, no one ever, like, you get competitive in yourself and you never want to get dropped from like by a guy, so it's just it's the best form of training, I think, like when you're not racing. So yeah, sometimes I kind of go out with them and kind of try to do their head in by beating them up sometimes.
I was gonna say, do you beat them?
Oh, It depends. Like, sometimes I kind of want to do it just because I know it cracks them mentally. But I think, like, when you're actually climbing with a one of the men male climbers, then that's always hard. But so I just train with the sprinters.
That's what I was going to say. You need to get with the sprinters then, don't you?
Although, like, even the sprinters in the men's peloton can climb. So, but yeah, it's like a good crew back in Girona. And yeah, it's kind of like home now for me. And yeah, I like it. So.
And lastly, what do you think, what would be really good to see for next year as part of the Women's World Tour? Is there any changes that you'd make?
It's a hard question. Yeah, I think one of the major things, I guess, in women's cycling is that, like, we don't have a minimum wage, and there's no, like, differentiation. There's nothing, like, for the teams if they... like, they don't have to have a minimum wage, so what is in it for them by paying everyone? Like, they don't have to do it, and unfortunately, there are riders that are so desperate for contracts that they would ride for free. So I think maybe kind of making it, like, almost like a UCI teams, and then maybe like UCI Continental, and differentiating it and making that the UCI teams do pay all the riders. And so then there's that step of making it's more like the teams have something that, like, if they are paying all their riders, they get something from it, and they're showing to be a better team from it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think also the races that they have included in the Women's World Tour have been really hard races to include, and I think it's been, yeah, it's a really good calendar this year.
Looking forward to a bit of a rest now the season's over.
Yeah, I think, like, it's actually gone really fast the whole year. But, yeah, like, I'm not a rider for Qatar, where the Worlds are this year, so I'm not really disappointed that I'm not going there. So, yeah, now this is my last race, and kind of looking forward to some downtime. Just kind of, like, probably enjoying Girona and not training, and then I still stay there for a month or two before heading home to Australia and, like, finishing my degree, and then it starts the nationals in January. So yeah, it kind of, time flies.
So that was Carly Taylor. Some very interesting things she said, I thought, Orla.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear her suggestions about some of the iconic climbs that the women could be going up. And I guess the World Tour is in its inaugural year, and there is a lot of talk afoot about changes to next year and additional races. I think it'd be great to see the women going up some of those iconic climbs. Why not?
The Giro Rosa is different. They go up some of the pretty iconic climbs in Italy, but I think one of the good things about the Women's World Tour, and we'll hear this a bit later on as well, has been that it's recognised different styles of races and racing, hasn't it? From the, obviously, one-day races, the cobbled classics, to the stage races.
Yeah, and I think there is always room for improvement for something like this when it's in its first year, but so far, I think what they've been doing is great, and it's, you know, up the number of days of racing from 10 under the old World Cup series to 35. It's meant that there has been a World Tour race every month, which we didn't have with the World Cup series. And as you say, it's much more varied style of racing. So we've got the stage races in it now instead of the one-day events. And that gives... that opens an awful lot more scope, really, for race organisers to take the race to some of these tough climbs.
Well, those great backdrops, you know, the Alps, the Pyrenees, and, you know, Paris and Madrid are great backdrops, but with a different kind of racing. And I don't think it's the best showcase for any. I don't think the men's racing looks particularly great there either.
And it's never really that exciting. Because they tend to be flat. Yeah, there are lots of crashes, but is that how we want the action to play out? Not necessarily. If we had more mountainous racing, then that's where you really want to see it all happening. And I think there is an appetite for that. Well, we know there's an appetite for that among the women's peloton. So it'd be great to see.
The question, I suppose, is how has the Women's World Tour caught the imagination of the riders? Because if the riders don't invest it with meaning, if it's not something that they're aiming for, then the competition lacks a sort of certain validity, doesn't it? It needs that investment, and maybe it's a lot to expect that to happen in year one.
Exactly. I think that will come. And I remember Lizzie Armit said at the start of the season, when she was asked about whether she was targeting the leader's jersey, and she was obviously wearing the rainbow jersey. So she was saying, well, I grew up wanting to wear this jersey. I didn't grow up wanting to wear the women's tour jersey.
Sorry, Lizzie Dagnan, do you mean?
Lizzie Dagnan, as she is now.
Well,
yes.
Just today, and that's not a sexist comment, but she got married yesterday. Yeah. And she did actually, you know, she did say on Twitter she was off to the passport office.
Exactly.
I thought he'd become Philip Armitstead.
Could be an argument for that. So you know, as she said, she didn't grow up wanting to wear this jersey, but obviously it is a new one. And I think that will change. And maybe if the public buy into it a little bit more, if the sponsors do, and the race organisers, because it's up to them, really, just how much coverage the races are given. So the UCI really, I think, have to have a tough line with the race organisers to make sure that there's more coverage. If all of that comes, then the riders will certainly buy into it.
Well, I'm looking down the list of the top 10 of the Women's World Tour, and Anna van der Breggen was seventh. She wouldn't swap her Olympic gold medal, I don't think, for Women's World Tour. The winner was Megan Garnier, the Bulls Dolmans rider. They were really pretty dominant throughout the Women's World Tour. Anna van der Breggen is joining that team, of course, next year. But in Madrid, Hannah Troop also spoke to Megan Garnier, the first ever winner of the Women's World Tour Series. Here she is.
How did you feel today when you were off the front? Was that obviously not planned?
Yeah, well, we wanted an aggressive race, and nothing seemed to be sticking, and of course, I didn't stick my attack either. So, you just had to try. You had to go for it, because that bunch sprint here is not really my personal forte, and if we can draw out some riders and make an exciting race, that was the idea.
And how does it feel to know that you've won the first inaugural Women's World Tour?
Yeah, I mean, it's a team win. Everybody worked so hard this year, and we came into every race trying to figure out how we could win that race, and it just so happens that at the end of the season that this was on my back, but it for sure was a team effort.
Was it kind of a season goal at the beginning of the season?
No, because, I mean, you always have your eye on it. It is something to look towards, but you, I think you need to take each race as it comes, and in that way, yeah, you make a team overall and the leader overall. But it's such a big goal at the beginning of the season. Of course, you're looking at it, but you can't focus too much on it.
And do you think you felt like a massive step on this year with it changing to Women's World Tour? Has there not been that much of a difference?
I think there's it's a step in the right direction. It provided a narrative through the entire season. It was nice to have the stage races as part of the series, along with the Spring Classics and the single days and the Vargarda TTT. So, I mean, it was a bunch of different disciplines, and I think that added a nice element to the overall classification.
What do you think would be good to see on the Women's World Tour next year?
More coverage.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa. Celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Go to rafa.cc for more information.
Sorry, I'm just having a cup of tea here. Yeah,
you made us another cup of tea. And Richard, lo and behold, is drinking from a cycling-themed cup. Tell us about that, Richard.
Well, it's a nice cup, isn't it?
It's beautiful, it is, actually.
This was
you did
actually
ask me to ask you about this in the next section. So, Richard, completely unprompted, tell me about your cup.
The reason for that is because it was sent to me by a cycling podcast listener.
Oh.
Stacey Snyder, American, who is a ceramicist. And she got in touch and asked.
Did she make that?
She made that.
That is beautiful.
It's very beautiful.
Stacey, well done. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, she sent one to me, and she sent one to Joe Dombrowski, I know, after hearing our podcast with Joe Dombrowski.
And no one else. Stacey, if you're listening, I love your car.
I think she sent it to other people as well.
Oh, just not me.
it's genuinely a really nice, big, you know, proper...
It's a proper mug
for tea, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly, lovely. Yeah. Proper slurp-a-thon out of that.
Yeah, brilliant. Anyway, let's hear from Lionel Burney, Whispering Lionel Burney, who does his monthly retro feature. This time, this month, Lionel is looking back at the first ever Women's World Road Race Championship back in the 50s. Over to you, Lionel.
With the World Championships coming up in Qatar in early October this month, we're looking back at the first time that a women's road race was held as part of the Worlds. There had been calls throughout the 1950s to add women's events to the World Championship schedule, but it's fair to say there'd been some resistance inside the corridors of power. But women's racing was catching the imagination, and finally in the spring of 1958 at a UCI meeting in Paris, it was decided to add a road race as well as a sprint and individual pursuit competition to the track programme. This was just 6 months before the road race championships were due to be held in Reims in eastern France, but all the best riders were there on the start line. It wasn't quite an event to match the men's road race, though. That was a 277-kilometre epic, which took the winner Ercole Baldini of Italy 7.5 hours to complete. By contrast, the women's race was just under 60 kilometres, or an hour and 50 minutes of racing. In fact, it would take until the late 1980s for the biggest one-day race on the women's calendar to test the riders over a distance of more than 100 kilometres. Nevertheless, in 1958, it represented a new dawn. It was a world title to fight for. And the winner of the first rainbow jersey for the women's road race was a 25-year-old from Luxembourg called Elsie Jacobs. You may be familiar with the name because since 2008, there's been a stage race called the Grand Prix Elsie Jacobs, held in and around Garnik, the town where she was born. Marianne Vos has won the race 3 times, Anna van der Breggen's won it twice, and Emma Pooley's also won it. This year's champion was the Polish rider, Katarzyna Niewiadoma. Elsie Jacobs came from a big family. She was born in 1933 and several of her brothers were bike racers, including Edmund, who'd ridden but not finished the 1956 Tour de France. Despite her obvious ability, there were few opportunities for Jacobs and her peers. With so few women's races in the mid-1950s, Jacobs would turn up at men's events in France, Belgium and Holland hoping to start, but more often than not, she'd be prevented from riding. And so, the first women's World Championship road race in 1958 represented a huge opportunity. Earlier that year, Luxembourg's Charlie Gaul had won the Tour de France, but Jacobs' victory was just as momentous. She broke away from the rest of the field and won by nearly 3 minutes, with two Soviet riders, Tamara Novikova and Maria Lukchina, taking second and third places. Jacobs set the women's world hour record later on that year, riding more than 41 kilometres on the famous Vigorelli track in Milan. Considering the men's record was only 5 kilometres further at the time, that puts Jacobs' ability into context. Her record stood for 14 years until Maria Crassari broke it at altitude in Mexico City in 1972. Jacobs won 15 national titles in Luxembourg, earning her the nickname the Grand Duchess, and she raced on until her mid-40s, winning more than 300 times. But the women's scene was still underdeveloped. There were no classics and few major stage races, and so the World Championships were the pinnacle of every season. A bronze medal in 1961 and 2 fourth places in 66 and 68 were the closest she came to winning a second rainbow jersey. After her death at the age of 64 in France in 1998, a museum was opened in her hometown, Garnik, in the west of Luxembourg. Her hour record bike and rainbow jersey are on display there, and every year the Grand Prix Elsie Jacobs is held, and perhaps people wonder about the significance of the name. Well, she was the first women's world road race champion, someone who blazed a trail for the likes of Reinders, Burton, Van Morsel, Longo, Vos and Armitstead.
So that was Lionel Burney. Interesting stuff, as ever, from Lionel. He does his research, doesn't he?
He does, and he makes it really interesting. I love it. I mean, it's incredible to think back before the World Championship had a women's race that riders were having to try to turn up to men's races. I mean, we think we've got it hard these days, I think, but if the women were having to turn up a race against the men, it'd be a different matter. But yeah, it's really interesting. Thank you, Lionel.
And of course, it sort of looks ahead to the World Championships next month in Qatar. We'll be talking about that in the next episode, I'm sure. To finish off this month's episode, we're going to hear a story that's a little bit different about a team that's been set up in Africa, African women's team. Now, this is the Africa Rising team, and it's based in Rwanda. Anybody who has listened to the Cycling Podcast has probably heard us raving about a book, The Land of Second Chances by Tim Lewis, which covers the men's cycling team in Rwanda, which is coached by Jock Boyer, the American. It's a fantastic book, a wonderful book. The women's team, which has been set up by Kimberly Coates, who's worked with Jock Boyer over the years, and Jock Boyer is involved in this project too. It's got more of a wider aim to really engage the whole continent and not just be restricted to Rwanda. So Hannah Troop, who we heard from in the last part, she spoke to Kimberly Coates recently. And let's hear, shall we, from Kimberly Coates, and then we'll come back out of that and talk a bit about this new initiative.
So Team Rwanda started in 2006, basically. Jonathan Jock Boyer came to Rwanda to help his friend Tom Ritchie do a race. And then they found some talent, and one of those riders at that race in 2006 was Adrian Nianchuti, who eventually went on to do the Olympics in 2012 and just did the Olympics in this past month in Rio. And we just started growing from there. They became the national team in 2007, 2008. I arrived in 2009, and we changed the name from Team Rwanda Cycling to Team Africa Rising about 2-3 years ago, because we had really started, we realized that it wasn't just Rwanda. What we wanted to do was take the model that we had done in Rwanda and help other countries such as Ethiopia, Eritrea, because what we found is that it's really going to take all of these countries working together to raise the level of the sport, to get more races in Africa, to raise the level of cycling, to establish grassroots programs. And, you know, it just can't be Rwanda. So Ethiopia and Eritrea, especially Eritrea, has a much longer history in cycling. They Eritrea really is the most talented country on the continent for cyclists. I mean, just raw talent. And so we've been working primarily with the men. And then it's been over the last, like, pretty much just this year, I've just watched the level of women's cycling come up, and there's just no races on the continent. And I thought to myself, you know, it's time to get the women out there. You know, these women are they're the ones that could actually race competitively, just like the guys, and they just need the opportunity. And so the Team Africa Rising for Women is, that's what we're working on right now, to fund a women's UCI pro women's team. And it will be made up of all African women. The women in Eritrea are the most experienced when you're looking at Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Rwanda. Rwanda, we have one great cyclist right now, Jeanne d'Arc, but she really needs to be around other women who have more experience. And we just finished a camp last month with Eritrean, Ethiopian, and a couple of Rwandan women, and it was really successful. And it's just, it is, it's about bringing them all together. One of the things that is interesting with these women is you read about the struggles between Eritrea and Ethiopia. Everybody knows Rwanda's history. And the Ethiopian girls left in a couple of weeks ago. They left a week earlier than the Eritrean women. And they were all just hugging and crying and sobbing when they had to leave each other. And I just keep thinking to myself, this is not the politics that you read about in the media. This is women who really want to help each other, and they know that collectively, together, that they can achieve their dreams. And that's what's really exciting. We have 5 riders on professional teams. Adrian races for World Tour Dimension Data. 2 others race for the continental, a portion of Dimension Data, and then 2 on Bike Aid. That's significant, because taking a rider from where they come from in Rwanda, the lack of education, the lack of experience, just the hurdles are immense getting them to the pro level. I think that's definitely something that we're very proud of. The riders have always been one. I don't ever see any real division amongst the riders. I think the biggest challenge, honestly, that we face is funding. we face issues with, you know, eventually we would like to turn over more and more to Rwanda. And unfortunately, this last year, we have received less funding than ever before with the Rwandan government, which is extremely frustrating because we really want to empower Rwanda to eventually take over their team. And the big hurdles that we face with that is training mechanics, training coaches, really putting a program in place that, you know, in the event that eventually Jacques and I retire from living full-time in Rwanda, it can continue without us. And, you know, it takes 10, 15 years anymore to be a really good race mechanic. And it takes a lot of money to do that. And we've always been in collaboration with the Ministry of Sport and this Rwandan Cycling Federation. And it's just until this last year that we've stopped receiving funding for races. We haven't received funding for training Rwandans. So that's been a bit frustrating. I've seen a difference in how the women respond versus how the men respond. And it's, I think it comes from the fact that, like, the women really get it. They understand that this is their one shot and they're not going to blow this. And they're committed, especially even on things like education, learning English. The guys, when we teach them, when they go to English class, they're kind of like, yeah, I'll do it. And the women are just like, can we have more hours? Can you give us private tutors? You know? And I just think that comes because as women, we tend to always come from a little bit behind the men anyway. And so we have to work a little bit harder to get ahead. I have 8 to 10 women that are solid on the list, ready to go, and probably another 4 on the fringe, depending on how much funding we get, whether we could take them as well. You know, we have the national champion from Eritrea, the national champion from Rwanda, Ethiopia. Those are primarily the 3 countries that we're working with right now, although there's a lot of phenomenal talent elsewhere. There's this fantastic woman in Egypt that I would like to talk more with. I haven't seen her race. She was actually at the Olympics. Jacques has got to see her race at the Continental Championships. There's just such a wealth of talent that's just completely untapped. And as it was with, let's say, Adrian or Danielle Teklehamanot or Merhawi Kudus, Natnal Berhane, Skabu Gourmet from Ethiopia, that once we start getting those women out there, they will be the ones that break through that barrier. And it only takes a couple to inspire the other ones in their country to go, yeah, I can do this. I can seriously do this. So I think the future long term, the depth is incredible. And once these women really begin to see that, yes, somebody like, let's say, a Johanna Dawit or a Jeanne d'Arc did it, that there will be more women that believe they can do it as well. Really, what we'd like to see is in 2020, seeing some Black African female cyclists in the Olympics, because it just hasn't happened. And I think a lot has to change in 4 years to be able to have more slots for African women. That's a big hurdle. I think from the continent, there was 3 at Rio, 2 South Africans and 1 Namibian. I mean, yes, I understand that women's cycling is not yet evolved in Africa to the level that it is in, let's say, Europe or US, but we have to start somewhere, and we have to start opening more slots. And that goes for men and women. There's just not enough slots for Africa, and that's a UCI issue. I'm just thinking that the US is the good stepping stone. I just spoke with Scott Nidham. He does some coaching consulting with us. He handles the BMC development team. And we were talking the other day, and he said, absolutely perfect idea. Let's start them where it's not like, oh my God, you know, totally freak out. And for instance, I had a rider who went to Bike Aid, and he was in really big European Peloton races, not, you know, top level world tour races or anything, but, you know, some seriously legitimate races. And he just freaked out. There was too many people. I mean, these guys and women race in Pelotons, like a big one at a big race would be like 80. And, you know, here's one of our Rwandan riders racing in a pack of like 150, and he just freaked out. He just didn't handle it well. So we had to take him back, work with him a bit. Another thing that's really good in the U.S. Is in Southern California. There's a lot of, you know, weekend crit races and circuit races and things like that. So it will be a good opportunity for them to get out there and see what it's like before, you know, we throw them in a major race in Europe. You know, it's funny because even coming off the plane last night, I'm like totally bundled up. I'm freezing, and it's not even that cold. It's, you know, Fahrenheit 70s. And I was like, oof, you know, I'm used to Africa, and Africans do not do well in the cold and rain in Belgium. And so what's nice is we would be basing in, you know, the southern part of the U.S., California, Arizona, New Mexico in spring, which is much better than spring in Belgium. So we'll get them started a little easier. Johanna, this is her first time to America. I have no idea what's going through her brain at the moment. It must be sensory overload, because she was at the Continental Championships in Morocco this year. She's raced in South Africa, I believe. But, you know, landing in Boston last night was, you know, she just stared out the window, just, oh my God. The Eritrean Cycling Federation is really great about advancing the sport of cycling in their country. And it's the number one sport in their country. And they gave her an award for representing Eritrea. They're so passionate about the sport. And everywhere you go, like when we were in Richmond last year at the World Championships, I think there was more Eritreans there than Americans watching the race. It's just because of their country's history and the fact that there's so many Eritreans abroad, they really get behind the sport. And having Johanna here in the U.S., I already see it on all the social media. The Eritreans are already coming out in droves to support her. Just saw this video that the Olympic Channel is getting ready to put out. It's not available yet, but I saw the what's going to be posted in the next couple of weeks on the Olympic Channel, and it talks about how Jeanne d'Arc in Rwanda has become such a role model to women that they featured this young lady who races single speed bikes, and that's all she talked about is, I want to be Jeanne d'Arc. I want to be Jeanne d'Arc. So these are the women that are going to be inspiring the future. And especially in a country with like Eritrea, where you already have that culture of cycling, I think it will go even faster. I would like to get this team in some major U.S. races. I would love to see the team, let's say, at Tour of Gila and Redlands Classic in California. And I'd like to see them do really well. And, you know, whether that's, I mean, ideally, yeah, wouldn't we all love a GC win? Of course. But I'd be really happy with even seeing them in the top five on a stage win, or a King of the Mountain, or Queen of the Mountain, sorry. And I want the world to see not only that they're legitimately talented cyclists, but then also seeing them for all of the obstacles that they've had to overcome to even get here. I mean,
as girls in the U.S., when we grow up, I remember getting my first bike when I was 5 years old and just riding from the time I was just a little girl and never having to go through the cultural stigma of being on a bike. I mean, in some of these places, you know, they still believe that riding a bike for a woman will hinder her ability to be married, that she won't be able to have kids. There's so much cultural baggage that comes with riding a bike for women. And I want these women to be able to bring that to light, that yes, number one, I can ride a bike like nobody's business, that I can inspire women in my country to get on bikes and that they don't have to deal with all the cultural baggage, and that I can support my family through racing. That's huge. Just the fact that, like in Rwanda, Jeanne d'Arc, she supports 11 people in her family on what she makes racing, and she's the primary breadwinner. And, you know, that's the future for these women. And that's what I'm most excited about long term. And I hope to also inspire women in America, because let's face it, the U.S. Peloton, the European Peloton, there is just not any women of color in that Peloton. It's sad. And there's this great cyclist in the U.S. right now trying to go pro, Aisha Gowan. And, you know, to be able to show women in the U.S. and Europe, black women, that they can, too, be a professional cyclist, I think it's just going to open so many doors, because I think it just comes down to a belief problem. Why don't African-American women get on bikes? I don't know. Probably because they don't see any African-American women on bikes. So let's change that. And I think we can inspire women of color, whether it's in America or Europe, to start considering the sport of cycling as a legitimate avenue towards a future, a career.
So that was Kimberly Coates talking about Africa Rising, the new African initiative, and some really interesting stuff in there.
It's absolutely fascinating. And hearing about that team and the work that's being done and what Kimberly's doing, it's really humbling. And I think it's very easy when you follow professional sport in whatever capacity, whether it's as a commentator, reporter, or an armchair fan, to, I guess, get a little bit cynical, really, about sport in general and how it's organised or whatever it is that you find that you can be critical about. And something like this, without, you know, really forces you to shed that cynicism and really forces you to have a look again at what sport can actually be about. And that's not to be trite in any way. I mean, we look at the culture that these cyclists are coming from, and it's a culture where Kimberly spoke about, you know, the cultural barriers that they have to face and the stigma they have to face. And, you know, lots of them come from small villages where the women do all of the work, and certainly it would not be seen fit or proper for them to be out riding bikes and to be able to inspire other girls to do that. I mean, I've been really lucky and gone to quite a few places, very underprivileged places in Africa, in the Middle East, and seen projects where sport really makes a big difference to people's lives, an actual difference to their lives and to their ambitions and to their global outlook. And something like this does exactly all of that, and hopefully will manage to change, even in a small way, cultural perceptions. And I think their ambitions are absolutely fantastic, beyond anything that they managed to achieve in professional cycling results. I think it's brilliant.
And things like that need a trailblazer, don't they? They need a pioneer. And Jeanne d'Arc sounds like just the candidate, the Rwandan rider who, you know, a comment that Kimberly made there towards the end about her, that she supports 11 people through her racing. Mm. You know, she's a family breadwinner. And, you know, looking into her backstory, when you read Tim Lewis's book that I mentioned earlier, Land of Second Chances, and about the horrors of the genocide in Rwanda, and all the writers really in his book, male writers, have been affected by that directly. Jeanne d'Arc, not so directly, although her mother was pregnant with her during the genocide. But her mother's siblings, I think she was one of 11 or 10, were all killed during the genocide, and she gave birth to her just, I think, as it was finishing. She had to run away and was concerned that she would have a miscarriage. There is a very good short film about Jeanne d'Arc, which is worth watching. Africa's Fastest Woman, I think it's called.
But won a prize recently, actually.
I think you're right.
At Kenyan Film Festival.
Worth looking up. But she could be the person, you know, who is a sort of role model for others, perhaps.
Yeah, and she's not alone either. I mean, recently they also managed to sponsor an Eritrean cyclist who became the first Eritrean cyclist to compete at a pro level in the US, Johanna Jewett. She got a guest spot on an American team at the Green Mountain stage race. And I was looking up the results. That was earlier in September. And she finished 9th in the opening time trial, 11th on stage 2, 8th on stage 3. It was a 4-stage race. And she didn't take to the final stage. But, you know, top 10 and right up there on her first ever pro-level race shows that it's not just, I'm stuck for words here.
What?
I know.
Historic.
It's happened. You've witnessed a moment, Richard. You've witnessed something. But yeah, it shows that it's not just lip service, and they do have this goodwill. So they, through what they're trying to do, so they did manage to get a guest spot for her. So they do have, I guess, an awful lot of support for what they're trying to do. But it shows that they've got the results to back it up as well, and that's what's encouraging, because it's one thing to set all of this up, but it's quite another to deliver on results. And you need the talent there, and that's clearly something that they believe they've got, and it looks like that they could well have, which is very promising indeed.
Yes, well, we'll watch that story closely, I think, and pick it up again next year if we can. So we better wrap things up there, I think, Orla. We've got lots for next month as well. There'll be the World Championships. I'm not sure if we'll be recording before or after the World Championships, but lots of other sort of off-season things. You mentioned I think you're riding a Sportif soon, are you not?
I'm either riding or going along to do a little bit of reportage. I will. I'll record on my bike.
Excellent.
Myself and Dame Kelly Holmes.
I thought you'd say Dame Leah Hervey there. your Sky Sports colleague. Because I knew you were going Leah. And when you said Dame, I thought, is there something...
There's not something you don't know, no. But I'll try to get Leah along. I'm going to get you along as well, Richard.
Will I be allowed?
Well, we'll borrow a skirt or something.
I can't wear my kilt.
You can wear your kilt and pretend. I've got some lippy that's just your colour.
Let's not do that. I don't think I'll get away with riding it, but I'm happy to come along with my microphone.
Yeah.
So let's do that, and we'll reconvene next month. Thank
Lovely.
You very much, Orla.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.